The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Oh, my name is Jane Thierfeld Brown, and I'm the Director of Student Services at the University of Connecticut School of Law. And with me today is Christy Willis, who is the Director of Disability Services at George Washington University. Salome Hayward was to be with us and sends her apologies. Unfortunately, she had an emergency and is not able to be here. So I am not an attorney, so I am not going to do what Salome would usually do, but we will try and throw in a few of the things that I've learned from her very recently. Well, over the 27 years we've known each other, so I've had a lot of time to absorb some info. Christy and I just figured out, and Christy and I have also known each other for a very long time, but we just figured out after lunch that between the two of us, we have 60 years in disability services. I know, isn't that amazing? Thank you, thank you. We started when we were 10 and 11. Right? Yeah, I'm just finishing. This is my 33rd year in disability services. And I've lived to tell the tale. My job at the law school is broader. I'm director of student services, but about 30% of my job is disability services. And we're going to talk to you today about something that I think challenges all of us in all universities, but especially in legal education, is people with invisible disabilities. This morning's panel, I believe, referred to it as non-apparent disabilities. We still use the invisible disabilities term. But we're going to talk about a number of different things. And Christy and I represent two different ways that law schools go about disability services. I am located at the law school. Our law school is separate from the main university. At University of Connecticut is located in Storrs, also known to those of us as the homeland. And we're in Hartford, about 45 miles away. So we are a standalone law school. And I am the disability services person at the law school. Christy's office, Christy provides services for the entire university at George Washington, including the law school. And I think that's true of a lot of you that are here today. Some of you have a standalone person in the law school, and some of you use your undergraduate services. And it really is, it's a pretty universal using one or the other model, and it's not like there's one that's better than the other. It's just the representation of what we do. We're going to talk today a little bit about student responsibilities and institutional responsibilities, because that really is what we're talking about, especially when we talk about students with invisible disabilities. We're also going to talk about a number of issues, and I'm saying them all, because we want you to keep us honest. We tend to, especially on these topics, as we get to things like psychiatric disabilities and students with autism and Asperger's, we could go on for quite a while. So we want to make sure that we're honest and address all of these things today. So keep us honest if you have to stop us to ask questions. We want to talk about the character and fitness issue with the bar. It's a big issue, and I get questions about it all the time. Bless you. We want to talk about some rogue faculty, as I call them, the students who are not granted accommodations, but they go to their faculty, and the faculty are granting the accommodations, and we want to talk about, I know, we don't like that. That's why we call that rogue faculty. We want to talk a little bit about hospitalizations and what that means and what it does to our students, because I know on our campus it's an increasing issue, and I think it is on everyone's campus. We want to talk about students disclosing versus hiding their disabilities, and at some point we want to talk about documentation, please. So we're going to attempt to get to all of this between now and no later than 4:45, hopefully a little bit earlier. I am going to ask that we do things a little bit different in this panel, because I think we have a real, we need a real dynamic interplay, because so much of this is very confusing. We are going to address a lot of the issues by cases, which I think will be helpful. But if you have questions during the presentation, please don't hold them till the end, because chances are we won't get to that. So as long as it's manageable, let's have questions during the presentation. And if we have to stop. And with that, I'll hand it over to Christy.
Well, thank you very much. One of the pieces that, I mean, as an opening, that This is not done in a vacuum. This is a very collaborative process, and I just want to say publicly to my staff and as well as the student affairs representatives here from our law school that this is very much a collaboration, a partnership. We, as Jane said, our services are aligned such that students with disabilities, regardless of at what level, undergraduate, graduate, professional schools, must document their need at our office. My associate director does all the documentation review, and then a memo is then forwarded to the law school for implementation. And sometimes that's done, we may each take a part in that, but we oftentimes will actually meet at the beginning of the term and talk about what's expected of the student, what accommodations may be appropriate within the context of the law school. I think it's really important for us as disability service providers to understand the context in which these accommodations are being determined. And I think that's really helpful for us to know before we make those decisions. One of the pieces that we wanted to talk about was to walk through a couple of cases. And I wanted to start off with one of what I consider our most complex cases, because what the student initially registered for with is not the disability for which has posed the most difficulties for us. This is a student who was, I would say, economically disadvantaged, educationally disadvantaged in terms of probably not coming from as rigorous an undergraduate degree program as many of our students might. And this is a student with vision loss for whom no accommodations had been made throughout his school years. He had self-accommodated, able to read, print with difficulty, literally, with his face in the computer, everything done by hand. So the first step, absolutely no knowledge of assistive technology before he came to us, and suddenly that reading load was insurmountable. So then the question is, what do we do? We introduce him to some assistive technology, and there's been a lot of resistance, even to this very day. There's been a lot of resistance to doing things in a way that he doesn't normally do things. So that was the first piece. We have an assistive technology lab within the law school with JAWS, with Zoom text. So all the accommodations were available, certainly got extended time, large print, all the traditional accommodations that he may need. Because of the way in which he reads text, he developed irreparable back damage. So then the second line of disability was a pain disorder. We then brought in an ergonomics person to assess the workstation, created a more accessible workstation. The student still chooses to take his exams lying down on the floor of one of our rooms rather than to use the assistive technology for exam taking. And then that led into what I would say some emotional involvement, some sort of mental health issues that have really been what have given us sort of the greatest challenge. It became this whole issue of disclosure. What do you disclose? Who do you disclose it to? There was a tendency to share a great deal of personal information with a broad array of faculty and staff. And so it became one of, let's contain this. There needs to be a designee or a point person to whom this information is shared, who will then, like you said, rogue faculty kind of doing things on the sly. All with very good intention, I might say. But I think that had to be sort of pulled back. It was very similar to a student that we had many, many years before who came in with ADHD, then that sort of the documentation then became an anxiety disorder, and then sort of further knowledge of OCD. Again, very similar issues where the student was sharing a great deal of information, and I think that the continual request for more and more and more was really a way of getting attention and getting other needs met of his that were really problematic for us. And again, had to limit that student to maybe one meeting a week rather than several times a day, which had gotten to be a problem. So in terms of the student, you know, preferential seating, 100% extended time, private test setting, enlarged text, assistive technology, reading services, note-taking assistance. We've now gone down to part-time status. The student's currently taking two classes and working at this point on the side, but we're now running up against the timeline by which you have to finish your degree program within a certain period of time. The other challenge was sort of a financial one, because at this point the student is $200,000+ in debt and nowhere near graduation. But he's far enough along that it's hard to stop. And yet it's been a, you know, a quandary, I think, for those serving him. Would it be better to step out, work, and to some degree what he's doing now, which is working part-time, going to school part-time? So he's in this sort of very difficult place of gone long enough to not want to stop and have no way to pay back his law degree or continue on. And then the prospects of full-time employment are limited given the array of disability conditions that he has. So I don't know that we have any magic answers. It's just been, which is not uncommon, I think, where we feel that we're the documentation on record is really not the documentation over time that you're actually serving. So that, I think, is not an uncommon, I guess, scenario or progression, I would say.
I'm going to interrupt for a second and just ask, how many of you have your largest population of students with disabilities on campus as students with psychiatric disorders? Can you raise your hands? How many of your largest population is learning disability? Anything else? What, for everybody else, what's your largest population, or do you not know? Unsure?
ADHD.
Okay. Anything else? Our largest population for the past 3 years, it was, up until about 7 years ago, it was LD. Then, for a number of years, it was psychiatric. For about 4 years, that was our largest population. For the past 3 years, it's been gastrointestinal illnesses. People seeing a lot of that? It's our biggest population on campus. A lot of our, and again, invisible disability, but requiring test accommodation, and most students need exam breaks and access to a bathroom during exams, and sometimes long breaks for the bathroom during exams. And I think we're going to see more of that coming up. There's something about this generation of millennials that we've done something to their GI tracts, because there's law school, absolutely, and the stress, but undergraduate also. Undergrads, we're seeing the same thing in our undergraduate experiences, that that's become the chronic, they fall under chronic health, and it's increasing tremendously.
On the opposite end of the spectrum is a student who had, I would say, equally complex needs, who handled the whole circumstance absolutely beautifully. This is a student who acquired a traumatic brain injury while in college, had pristine documentation, very comfortable in her own skin, I would say, very much like your panelists earlier here. Yes, I have this disability. It doesn't have to define me. I know what I need. Was very articulate about what she needed. Initially, I think her hope had been to create a part-time day program that she designed herself. That was already approved. The end result is that she did participate in the nighttime program. The challenge for her was really one of stamina, cognitive and physical stamina, in addition to sort of processing speed issues. But she had an extraordinary array of accommodations. The least traditional, I suppose, was a number of breaks throughout the exam period that she needed for rest breaks. She received extended time, note-taking services, quite a bit of the sort of traditional accommodations. The other thing in her favor was absolute passion for what she wanted to do. I think that's a differential here, too. I think we have one student who, to this day, is a little uncertain as to a direction, and another student who had a very clear direction, which was animal rights. And but I think, not that she can't work full time, but I think her self-knowledge has indicated to her that she will work part-time, most likely, moving forward. But she flew, apparently, through the bar with extraordinary accommodations, but she had all of her ducks in a row in terms of documentation, documentation of use of accommodation, documentation that supported that need, and graduated at the absolute top of her class, is my understanding. So it was really sort of the whole spectrum along the way. I thought it would be helpful for Jane to address the students with Asperger's or autism case studies, too. We did have a student who has Asperger's, came to our office with his mother to document his disability. So at this level, it's not something we certainly expected, but it's happened at least three times where we've had parents coming to the intake with their students, which I believe is of some concern. We had another father who, when the daughter missed the deadline for applying for accommodation for the bar, pressured the bar into allowing it after the deadline. So a very powerful parent, but I'm not sure that's beneficial to the future attorney. So
interesting. Interesting. And I think we're going to see much more of that as we... I'm going to stand. Is that okay? Sorry. Do I need the mic? Or is this mic on?
Yeah.
Is that okay? Sorry, I have a very bad back, so I'm going to accommodate myself by coming to here. I'm sorry, I can't sit that long very well. My specialty within disability services is services for students with autism and Asperger's in higher education. I have two students with Asperger's right now at the law school, and whatever you're seeing at your law school, and I'll ask in a minute, but you're going to be seeing more over the next few years. The other thing you're going to see more of, as Christy mentioned, that the students come in with a parent, we're also going to be seeing more law students on the spectrum, the autism spectrum, who have parents or a guardian or conservator, which is not something we usually see with an attorney or someone in legal education. We are going to see more of this, especially as parents are taking their very highly capable students on the spectrum and getting financial conservatorship over them until they feel that they are more able to handle their own finances. What I've suggested to several of these families is I'm not quite sure how the bar is going to look at that, because one of the things the bar is very concerned about is how you manage your finances. If you need a conservator for your own personal finances, how can you possibly pass character and fitness? But we're going to talk more about character and fitness. So, student responsibility versus institutional responsibility. Very important difference, and something that we're seeing a lot of change in, especially with millennial law students. I'm getting, as I'm sure you all are, more calls from parents than I ever have. And it's not something that we're really used to at law school. You always hear it when somebody answers the phone as, Jane, it's a mom, and then they're really, it's a dad, and then there's a big difference. And the only thing that really gets these folks to respond, especially when it's about their student with a disability, is, gee, your son or daughter is a first or second or third, whatever, your student. That means in whatever many years, they're going to be an attorney. Would you hire an attorney whose dad had to make their phone calls for them? Thank you very much, Dr. Brown. Boom. That's the only thing that kind of gets folks to back off. But we really are going to be seeing even more of it, I think, where it comes to students with disabilities. And I'm sure, Christy, undergrad-wise, aren't you seeing a lot more?
Huge.
Huge numbers. And I think the way we say it in disability services is if students have helicopter parents, students with disabilities have Blackhawks. And it really is true. It's very true. But these families of the students that we're seeing, they have been advocate and CEO of that kid's education. And the reason they are getting as far as they have is because of these very strong, assertive advocate parents. And it's very hard for those parents to then just cut it off and say, he or she is okay now. Here you go. And they've done that all through college, and there are many, I'll just relate a story about a student with Asperger's. A disability services person called me this week and said, Jane, I think we need you to come do some training. There was somebody in my outside office, you're going to love this, Christy, there was somebody in my outside office, and he was on the phone, and he was yelling and screaming at his mother, and he was using four-letter words, and it was inappropriate, and when he was done screaming at her, he took the cell phone, and he threw it against the wall, and then he turned around and in a totally calm voice said to the secretary, hi, I'm here to see Jane for my 4 o'clock appointment. And she said, and that secretary was just so upset, she didn't understand he has Asperger's, she needs some training. I said, who needs training? That student's being inappropriate. You can't let that happen. And she was like, but he has Asperger's, we're all a little afraid. And I'm like, oh my gosh, and you have an outer office? Oh my gosh, who's got that much space in disability services? I was so appalled by the space issue. I think the important thing is that our students are getting excused for their behavior. And if you walk away with nothing else from Christie's and my panel today, please remember that disability never excuses behavior. Never. Manifestation determination is a term that I only learned now about maybe three years ago. It's an IDEA term, and I'm sure IDEA is familiar to all of you, but the laws that our students are under in kindergarten through 12th grade, and in many, many places it starts in birth to three. IDEA has this section in it called manifestation determination, which means if a student does something and breaks some sort of rule or conduct in anywhere in the public schools, some private schools too under IDEA, if there is this manifestation determination meeting, and if it's determined that the behavior was caused by the disability, it magically goes away. Well, manifestation determination magically goes away with the high school diploma. And it doesn't exist in higher ed or in graduate education. It also doesn't exist in real life. And families don't understand that. And neither, a lot of our K-12 system doesn't either. And it's really important that we educate not only each other, but our faculty and our families about that, because they really believe that if their student does something very egregious on one of our campuses, that it's going to be magically excused because they have a disability. And we know that's not true. Families also believe that will happen in the courts if they do something on the outside for which they're arrested. And it's something that we really need to understand and practice in our classrooms too. Because especially with students with psychiatric disabilities, we're starting to look at a lot of disruption of the campus environment. Some of our students who on the outside look very typical are not quite so typical. So I want to relate a case with one student, just with all the different things that we mentioned before that we're going to touch on. I started getting phone calls about this one student who I knew about but had not disclosed to my office. And a couple of faculty were calling, and you know the phone calls. Jane, is this one of yours? You know, those phone calls, we all get them, you know. And I, of course, said, I'm not sure. Who are we talking about? And the professor went on to describe a small seminar class where the student had very interesting things to say, but spent most of the time in the class when other people were talking with his eyes closed, nodding his head, and rocking back and forth, and muttering to himself. And I said, how are the other students reacting in class? Oh, everybody's really scared of him. He just seems like he's really not all there. But when he talks, he's right spot on. So, you know, everybody's glad to have him in class. And I said, well, that's wonderfully welcoming of you, but is he getting anything out of this? And why is he rocking and muttering to himself in class? I asked to see the student who willingly came to my office to talk and had the exact same behaviors in my office. I'm a little more comfortable saying, gee, you're talking to yourself. Did you know that? And, of course, the faculty member wasn't comfortable. And the student kind of under his breath, oh, I do it all the time, talking to himself. And I said, is there, you know, do you have a history of this or any, have you ever been diagnosed with anything that might cause you to talk to yourself? And, you know, he went on to describe a few things, really didn't want to tell me about anything, but did say, I don't like to talk about this, you can talk to my doctor, and gave me written permission. And I explained to him that he had to call his doctor also. His doctor actually called me the next morning, and I'll call the student John, but he said, so, you've met John, I've been asking him to come and talk to you. And I said, yes. He said, boy, he's a real nut job, huh? This is the board certified psychiatrist. That concerned me. I wanted to say, could you put that in writing? But I didn't. My concern was right then, having had the medical professional say to me, John is a nut job, which I madly documented, what does that now mean as a law school? If I have been told that by a medical professional, what does that mean for character and fitness? Which I immediately brought to, I didn't want to bring to the dean because I didn't want to put him in that situation because he's the one that has to sign the bar forms. But I brought to two people, our risk management and student affairs at the larger university and somebody in the general counsel's office. All of whom were like, how do you find these psychiatrists? And I said, you know, the student did, I didn't. Turns out he is the doctor for at least six of our students. And I'm hoping not to get these kinds of reports very soon. But I think we have an obligation now that, of course, the doctor did go on to say in our conversation that he's not sure that this student could ever practice as an attorney. And that concerned me greatly also, and I asked if he had told the student that. And he said, yeah, we talk about it once in a while. Of course, we're not trade schools. Not everyone is coming to law school to take the bar and to practice as an attorney. And we all know that the majority of our faculty often have not taken bars in the states in which they're teaching. So how do we then justify letting the student go through school? In my mind, we have to say to them, you have very significant character and fitness issues that you're going to have to deal with. Now, some of the states that you represent may be more understanding. I understand that we're being recorded, so I'll just say kindly that our state's not quite so understanding, and we don't have a very good track record with our bar examiners as far as mental health and mental illness go. So the character and fitness issue for this young student is going to be a large issue, and I think all of our law schools have to work out how are we going to address that issue with our deans or whoever is signing the character and fitness for some of these students with significant mental health. In Connecticut, they ask to disclose any mental health issue, but they specify any paranoid schizophrenic diagnoses and other types of, and they list. So if you have any of those diagnoses, it, again, is the student's responsibility. And this is where I think things get very murky. What is the student's responsibility? We know the student has a responsibility to disclose. What is the institutional responsibility to disclose in this case, or many similar cases of students with psychiatric disabilities? And that brings in the hospitalizations. In Connecticut, students are asked about hospitalizations within 5 years of taking the bar. Since I've been in the office Tuesday, this semester we had three students that had psychiatric hospitalizations. So how does that, and I'm sure my campus is not unusual, maybe in the positions you're in, you may not know about when that happens, depending on what your policies are. But these are the kinds of things that we need to be very upfront with students who are disclosed to disability services offices, because many students don't realize the questions on the bar. They're not looking at the bar app form until they're ready to apply for the bar or ask for accommodations. And I think it really behooves us as people interested in working with students with disabilities at law schools to look at the applications of the states where our students are taking the exam and see what we need to feed back to the students. prior to them maybe not enrolling but continuing their education, because these are really tricky issues. Are other people having these same kind of issues on campus? Nobody? You are also. Say that again, inpatient treatment
for addiction.
I would look at the BAR app also, but I think, you know, and your school, you have to look at your school policies also. There's many studies on law students and alcoholism, and we have many students addicted to alcohol and who are dealing with that. The drug addiction issues in inpatient, unless your school says if you are attending an inpatient program or something that says if you're addicted you may not participate in law school, I don't know that you can exclude someone. Thank you. I was having trouble hearing Kara. Sorry.
But what about providing an accommodation? What if someone's hospitalized or goes to an inpatient program and then wants to be accommodated either for the attendance policy? Usually I encourage them to go on a leave of absence, because even after they come out of the inpatient program, they have to do pretty intensive outpatient treatment. But sometimes they don't want to, and they're sort of the one thing that's stable in their life is law school, you know, thing. And so they want to come back, but they've missed so many classes, they really, are beyond our attendance policy. But they want an accommodation because of what they're sort of arguing is a disability.
I hate to make the generalization, but I'm going to start the conversation by saying, in general, we do not accommodate the attendance policy. We use the ABA attendance policy. Now, of course, you know, somebody has a death in the family, somebody's very ill. Yes, if you're gone for a short time, that's one thing. We usually say if you're out 2 weeks, that's the outer limit. After 2 weeks, catching up is next to impossible. So we're trying to get the faculty to pass something like that or something they're comfortable to get into our student handbook so that we have written policy. But really, that is a very tricky area, because unless you have something written, you really only have the ABA to go back to, the ABA requirement. And I go back to the ABA residency requirement, that if you read the residency requirement, it says, you know, it's the number of minutes you're in the chair, and they give you the amount of minutes per credit. And that's why I know in the Northeast we're really struggling to make up so many of those classes missed because of weather this winter. Well, if it's that specific, how do we say to somebody, oh, you were inpatient for 6 weeks and now you're doing day treatment for four, don't worry about it. You know, we have to accommodate you, you have a disability. Because the federal definition, I'm trying to channel Salome at the moment if I can, but the federal definition of addiction, help me Christy if you can, I believe it's you're recovering, you're not currently addicted. So you're not recognized by the university as a person of a protected class as having a disability if you're currently addicted. So that's sort of the line of demarcation for people with substance abuse issues. So once you're through that program, am I right?
Right.
That once you're through that program, you then can self-disclose and be recognized as a person with a disability with all the benefits thereof. But until you have gotten to the other side of your addiction, you're not protected by ADA. But there's many issues like that. Even when people say, you know, my mom has cancer and I need to go home and take care of her, I'll be gone 4 or 5 weeks. You know, can't I just follow online? Can you record my classes? That's when we say, no, please go take care of your mom and then come back. You know, but it is, it's very, very difficult issues. Yes, go ahead.
It's difficult when a student...
Can you all hear?
I think we're supposed to...
Can you use the mic? Sorry.
Janet Mosseri, when you have a student who might face character and fitness issues and you have that conversation with that student, I'm always afraid that that student's not going to then go out and seek the treatment that he or she needs because of the questions on the bar application. And in Florida, we do have those questions dealing with mental health and hospitalization. And I've had more than one student, you know, leave my office not sure what's going to happen.
I couldn't agree more. We have the exact same issue, and John Bauer, a faculty member on our campus, has really been fighting with our state bar examiners with a large group of people to get those things changed, to be able to allow the future attorneys to have good mental health practices. I agree, it's a big issue, and I think that's why increasingly law schools have psychologists or psychiatrists working on their own campuses, because students feel more comfortable getting their help on campus. No, not at your campus? I agree, that's more the hiding versus disclosures.
Let me turn this over to, this is Andra from our law school, because this was an issue we discussed the other day.
So. Right. Andra Chernak, GW University Law School. One of the things that I've actually spoken with bar examiners about is that they often do, and again, it depends on the jurisdiction that you're looking at, they will take a look to see if the steps that the student has taken to rehabilitate themselves, so that it shouldn't be a hindrance or a stigmatization. I realize, I see the skepticism in your eyes. I get that. But we often use it as sort of the carrot to get the student to go, that, you know, it is only if you take the steps to rehabilitate yourself that you would be able to get through the application and the examination process to then go on to get your license to practice law. So that's one of the things that we handle. And with regard to the other question about the student who went out to seek treatment, I mean, I would say if it's within your realm of possibility to do a retroactive leave of absence on that student, because a lot of times another one of the concerns are the financial ramifications of, you know, what are they going to do if over the course of the semester it's 20, 40, 80% that you are going to be losing, to do a retroactive leave of absence, you know, for that student to try to get them to help them out, and also use that as a carrot to get them, to encourage them to go to seek treatment.
I agree. I think it does depend on the state, because some states and some bars are much more open to saying you're seeking the treatment and that's what we're looking for. So far, that's not what Connecticut's been saying. So, and I think that, which state are you from?
Florida.
Florida. And Florida and Connecticut are very similar.
Florida does look for rehabilitation in a number of areas, but when you're talking to a student and knowing that maybe that rehabilitation, especially if the student is later on in the educational process, it may delay license. You know, until the bar feels that you are fit and you are rehabilitated, and during that period of time, when loans kick in, you know, repayment kicks in, and, you know, so even though Florida will look at rehabilitation, you know, you have a student sitting in front of you that's not buying with your own.
I absolutely agree, and Connecticut's been better about it more recently than in the past. I think the issue is, as soon as students hear, this could be a problem later on in my career, they have a hard time accepting the treatment. And I think that is an awful deterrent to something we really want students to get. I'm a big proponent of mental health assistance, and I don't think our students are doing what they might need to for fear that it's going to come back at them with the bar.
I mean, I would also like to add that I think it's important to point out to the students that the potential consequences, both in their grade performance as well as other behavioral issues when not seeking treatment, is also something that would bear comment by the administration in terms of the determination of character and fitness. And so it really would be in their best interest long term to look at the best ways to resolve those issues rather than, look at the risk.
I'm going to turn the conversation for a minute. Did you have a question? Thank you.
It may have been more appropriate elsewhere, but relative to the bar, Temple Grandin, do people know who she is? She was in an interview. She had a recent book out. And she said, and she could afford this, she said, if you need mental health care and the issue of getting benefits, government benefits, try and not get those benefits. You can disclose when you choose, but try and get private care that isn't as spread out in all your records. That doesn't mean don't say it, don't admit it on the bar, but there is certain publishing and records in a government system that leaves you absolutely no privacy, which the bar will protect in a way that the other systems don't.
It may be, but for law students, they are required to disclose any treatment or diagnosis.
Yes, but I didn't say that. I said, but that's within what we hope is a closed system. Mm-hmm. And she's saying get the care privately, try not to get government disability services. She didn't say don't disclose. She just put those things on it.
Right.
Because then you control who has the necessary information.
So she's saying don't go on SSDI. Don't go on Social Security Disability if you can help it.
Yes, because it's absolutely no privacy.
Right. Let's turn the conversation for a few minutes to things that we deal with students with invisible disabilities with all the time, and things like clinics, externships, and we'll talk a little bit about employment. I'm seeing lots of heads going, and this is a huge issue for all of us, where we hear from a student doing an externship and we hear from an attorney that we have a good relationship with, oh my gosh, who are you sending me? What is going on? He can't get anything done. He's disrupting the whole office. What's going on? And we had that this semester, and the student had very significant ADHD and was brought up to not to believe in medication, and that medication was evil. And he only used natural methods, and it is now a real problem, and we're afraid that we may have burned a placement, because the student would not disclose, would not get any accommodation, and unfortunately really had a problem in this attorney's office. So I think we have to really think about what our students are required to do outside of our campus and outside of those kinds of accommodations, and are those students appropriate for externship? I think after this experience, we would say if this student requested another externship, we'd say no, because it really was not something that was a good experience for us, for the student, or for the employer, or the supervisor. So I think that is something we have to really keep an eye on, because sometimes if you don't have a relationship with the externship supervisor, you may not hear about it. Same is true, I think, for students with significant learning disabilities or psychiatric disabilities, or possibly autism and Asperger's, or any of that. The clinics is another place, and there was an excellent article written a couple years ago by Nora Wiley from BC and several other colleagues, who wrote about people with LD and ADD and ADHD working in their clinics. And I think that for most of our students, getting that kind of clinic experience prior to going out for employment is incredibly valuable, where it's more in-house, where we can work with the faculty, work with possible supervisors on our campus. However, the student also needs to, at some points, be willing to disclose to people and or accept some accommodation. I think for too long we've just said, well, we have to just let them do this because they have a disability. And I think at many places we're reaching a point where we need to say, you have a disability which you've disclosed. You won't accept any accommodation. You're now, whatever happens, you're responsible for. Nobody's going to go and say, oh, but you can't hold it against him. He has a disability, or her. And I think that's really important, and we're getting pushed to those things further and further.
To this point, I think we, like was said before, I think the emphasis has always been to, you know, protect the anonymity of the student in terms of grading. So I think the message to the student is often, do not disclose. Keep this to yourself. And yet we're telling them a very different thing when they go into the clinic or internships, for good reason. I think it's really important. We've personally had probably more experience with this in the health sciences and some of those clinical settings than at this point I've had directly with the law school circumstances. But I think it's really important for students to know what is going to be expected of them, what's the skill set that they are going to need to have. And then looking at how are they going to be evaluated, And then what accommodations can be made? And I think this is a dialogue, it's a discussion about what's the expectation, how are we going to meet those expectations. And so I'm trying about that site, you know, whatever that site might be. We had a recent experience, it was not a law school experience, where there was a lot of pushback from the site at the thought of having a deaf student in this case, without any exposure to the particular student in question. And what is our responsibility also as an institution? In some ways, that is an extension of our institution. So what are our kind of obligations or liabilities if, in fact, that facility is saying no? I think there's something to be said for certainly preparing the student, preparing the site, and having an ongoing evaluative process on how that student's progressing. I think oftentimes that's not done until there's a problem at hand, and I think if we were a little bit more conscientious about the starting point, we might have some better outcomes. We oftentimes, too, have established an annual beginning of the semester, beginning of the year process where we meet with the student, meet with the clinical supervisor, look at what's ahead for that year, and those accommodations may change from year to year depending on what the requirements will be, but I think that ongoing feedback, it can be very helpful. We have a student on the who has Asperger's, and we've actually established a monthly meeting between the student and the advisor because there was a more frequent need for feedback on some of the social interactions or social competencies that this student had.
Interesting. It's interesting that we're having this conversation because if we had it 10 years ago, we'd probably all be looking at each other like, what are we talking about? Here we're talking about schools wanting to offer accommodation to law students who are not accepting it. You know, when you think about that, I mean, really, the law schools have come so far in what we do to accommodate people, and yet the culture has not. The culture is still one of don't say anything, because if other people find out, it will be bad, especially when it comes to mental illness, especially when it comes to psychiatric treatment. A lot of our students that have extended time or get a separate room, their biggest stress factor several weeks before the exam is, what am I going to tell everybody? Why aren't I going to be in the room? What do I say? And, you know, I usually tell them you had a cough and that I pulled you out of the room because I didn't want you getting everybody sick. And that kind of makes them go, oh, well, but no, I don't want to lie. Well, true, we don't want to set that up, but if that's causing the stress before exams, oh my gosh. You know, 10 years ago, if somebody said, oh my gosh, law schools offer so many accommodations, you'll be refusing them, the students would say, are you kidding? There's no way. I think there's a lot of things that are happening now, especially in clinics, that where students are getting a lot of practice that they did not used to get as frequently. I know our clinics have tripled in the last few years, so we have a lot more clinic opportunities for students. One of the clinics your example about the student with the hearing impairment reminded me, we had a student working in a clinic and we asked that student to offer accommodation. We offered that student accommodation in the clinic setting with the hearing impairment and the student refused. And the clinic setting really was going downhill very quickly. The student was not effective. It was an unusual situation because one of the professors actually had a hearing impairment and was very open about it. And the student would not disclose and eventually was having serious grade problems in the clinic and preferred to drop rather than disclose the disability. I'm not sure why, but it's those kinds of things that are surprising me more and more. And I think we're going to, as our programs move more into a practical setting, I think we're going to see it increasing because students really have gotten the belief, and I don't know why because there's so much mainstreaming now, but they've gotten the belief that I'm not supposed to tell anyone at law school, and it is a huge issue. Any other questions on that before I move on? Yes.
Because I had a personal situation with this not writing, being able to, essentially, and have, I would say, some expression was used, very certified evaluation, but on short notice. I've become very involved with these issues. And one of the things I started to find out, actually, when I was in George Mason's Disability Technology event in October, I had my challenges at a private law school and a private university. And what I found out, George Mason, I know about Ohio State, Iowa, the public universities have disability studies. They have people being trained to work in the field. They have situations for their students, especially the major anchor state universities. And that's true of City University of New York also. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the private universities don't have that, don't have the money or the public interest to that degree. Some do, like this one. So what your experience is at Connecticut, one reason is it's the state. So not everyone as an employee trying to do this or as a law student will find this. And the other thing that's very interesting to me that I found is that the disabilities law and IDEA is fine, but all the students who went through that are now going into higher education. And I think one reason you're finding so many students with things is when they get to graduate school, there isn't that set of mandates and compliances. And the learning disabilities, ADD, the stomach problems, the support system isn't there. And maybe they're calling the parents because there's not a big community institutionalized, federally mandated situation. And I said, what are they doing for the students coming out of what ends at 12th grade and going into higher education?
I understand what you're saying. I think there are things in place, though. I think most higher ed institutions now do have disability services. Maybe the private schools have smaller offices than some of the public schools, but I think that most schools do have something for the students that are in K-12 and used to getting accommodations. The students who are going to institutions that don't have anything, my comment to them is always, do you want to be a college student or do you want to be a pioneer to try and get services? And you have that choice. Nobody says you have to go to this institution. You can choose. That's possible. Yeah, you try and do your homework before, but you can't always predict. You're right. Let's move to documentation a bit, because I think documentation, the issues are changing a lot. And again, I won't address this as well as Salome does, unfortunately, but with the new ADA regs that actually go into effect next week, what we can require for documentation is very different. The main thing that leaves us is that number one issue for disability services was that determination of, does this person have a disability? That goes away. We now don't deal with the, does this person have a disability? We keep the parts that say, does the disability rise to the level of needing accommodation at our setting? But that subtle change does make things different. So that if you got documentation for somebody that had an invisible disability and you looked at it thinking, is this a person that has a disability? Can I even determine an accommodation? If it says, you know, some of those ADD documentations that say, has symptoms like that is seen of students with ADD? You know, those that you want to say, couldn't you have given me something a little more black and white so I maybe could? We no longer are at the point where we're saying, is this a disability? Our role is to look at, do we need accommodation? Does it rise to the level of needing accommodation or does it not? That's one of the major differences. But I think the other thing that's going to impact us a lot, and you've probably all heard about it from last week, NBME, the National Board of Medical Examiners. Do you know more about this? Because you do medical school and I don't.
I just got the email.
You got the email. Got the email right away. There was a case with NBME on determining accommodations for people taking the national medical boards. And what the courts found was very different, especially for graduate and professional schools. You could no longer say you must have a disability like ADD or learning disability diagnosed in childhood. You can't go back and require other testing that wasn't already given. You have to look at what the medical professionals ruled as the required testing. They changed it. Go and look at it. It's very interesting. Do you remember the name of the case?
No.
I don't either. It just came out last week, but it was on, does anybody know the name of it? It was on every disability listserv. We have somebody with the paper. There's always somebody with the paper.
Settlement between the United States of America and National Board of Examiners. Document number appears to be DJ number 202-16-181.
Do you have the piece there, that little paragraph they read about documentation and what you can ask for?
Didn't highlight this copy.
Okay, don't bother. That's okay. Thank you. Thank you for giving that info. I appreciate it. I think what's going to happen from the NBME settlement is that we're going to get a lot more advice from our general counsels about what we can and can't look for in documentation. And it may affect how we accommodate. There was one person who said to me yesterday, the mission at our school, Jane, is we just find a way. If we can find a way to accommodate a student, we will. I don't think that's the way most law schools feel. I think most places feel very differently in that they want it to be fair and equitable to all students and not just find a way to change everything for a student. So I think the documentation is about to change, and I think we really need to keep looking at it and keep getting ourselves educated, because our students are going to be required different things, and very different things for, say, the MPRE. And somebody else found it. I love being with lawyers. I tell you, they got all, look at this, on the iPad. Oh, gosh, number 13. You could have read it. Oh, gosh, the font. Okay. NBME requests for documentation shall be reasonable and limited to documentation that establishes A, the existence of a physical or mental impairment, B, whether the applicant's impairment substantially limits one or more major life activities within the meaning of ADA, and C, whether and how the impairment limits the applicant's ability to take the USMLE under standard conditions. It goes further. This is the part I thought was interesting, number 14. NBME will carefully consider the recommendation of qualified professionals who have personally observed the applicant in a clinical setting and have determined in their clinical judgment and in accordance with general accepted diagnostic criteria as supported by reasonable documentation that the individual is substantially limited in one or more major life activities. Thank you. That's a substantial change. That's a real change from what we were doing, and it's now telling us we can't question as much. I still, if I get that sort of has symptoms of ADD, I'm going to ask for permission to talk to the evaluator. But in general, what we were going by before has changed. So I would encourage you to look at that, because I think as a professional school, we're going to be looked at similarly, and there will be court cases, I'm sure. And I know there's some things going on with the MPRE now that students are questioning the same thing. So, because there's so much documentation requested and people getting new documentation while they're in law school because it's too old, and then we get into the money again of how do students who already have $200,000 in loans afford new documentation for the bar examiners and those kinds of things. Okay, anything else on documentation? Good. We're good with documentation. Christy?
Okay.
Just a few of the things that we've done. I mean, just some accommodations that we've made. But before that, I mean, I think we're in looking at our law students and really across the board with this disability support services population in general. Students with psychological disabilities have risen to the third largest population that we serve through our office. And I can just say, as a disability support services person and my staff, I struggle with this. You know, who should we be serving? Who should be perhaps supported by the University Counseling Center or by both? You know, what accommodations are appropriate, oftentimes at least in some of the cases, we're seeing a need for more direct one-on-one support than we are sort of the traditional accommodations. Perhaps, you know, private test setting might occur occasionally, extended time. But again, I think with the sort of broadening of the definition, I think we're all challenged with the burgeoning population. We're certainly seeing students with more complex needs.
Absolutely.
That's what's always interesting about this work. A few of the things that, and just in terms of just traditional accommodations, we talked a little bit about the clinical setting, but one of the other areas that we're looking at is research and writing. I actually have two writing specialists on my staff. You know, learning specialist is sort of the category or proper title, but I have two people on my staff that work as writing specialists, and they've been collaborating quite a bit of late with the writing center staff within the law school. So I think there's a great partnership to be had there in terms of providing some consultation to the staffs of those departments. Writing, certainly I've had some students who have been quite frightened by that requirement and have avoided it at all costs, but eventually they do need to take the research and writing. I think in terms of IT kinds of things, I think it was talked about before, that whole issue of integrity. I think we've worked that out in-house so that the exam that our students provide is one or more students that use drag and dictate. And so there's been a real interest in making those exams look the same, and I think we've worked out that problem quite nicely. The other issue we had to do with laptop use. You know, laptops are common accommodations for all students, or common for all students, but they are a needed accommodation for select students with disabilities. The normal protocol in law school had been, if your laptop goes down, then you have to revert to the blue book. But that doesn't work for the student for whom it's really an essential accommodation. So the solution to that was to purchase several additional laptops that were available should those go down midstream. We've also added, and it seems to be something that's happened at some of these other law schools, we have a half-time University Counseling Center psychologist who is dedicated to the law school, and that's been a tremendous addition, again, I think, in recognition of this burgeoning population, many of whom are not registered with my office, just the stress level of being in law school. And finally, I think, you know, kind of back to just the reinforcement, I think we need to be always mindful of responding to behavior and performance and not to the disability itself. And we struggle with this. We have either at all kinds of levels, either even at the professional school levels, not necessarily law school, where either accommodations are being made informally until things get too dicey, and then they refer the student to disability support services. We get the situation where the faculty feels the designation of disability means that they're supposed to provide them something more and different versus holding the student to that academic standard. And being really reinforcing that we as an office are not only the sort of advocacy arm for students with disabilities, we're we're there just as much to support the GW community, faculty, and staff. And so I think that's an important message to send, that this is a shared responsibility, but there is no separate academic standard for students with disabilities.
Darren Neely from Capital University Law School. You discussed the situation where if an accommodation requires use of a laptop, you have a backup plan in case the computer crashes. We've been lucky enough to not have more than one student at a time need that, so we have one room for that purpose. I'm curious about the reverse of that, if you will. We have a couple of professors who require the exam to be written. Whether it's because it's a tax exam and they in their heads think laptops shouldn't be needed, they don't think the answer should be too wordy, how, if at all, that has been dealt with students whose accommodation is the use of a laptop. And I've heard stories that in the past some people will have someone else rewrite it, which I don't think I'm comfortable with having. But unfortunately, the other alternative we know of is to have one or two exams turned in typed, which pretty much gives away that there was an accommodation.
I'll be honest, I don't believe we've ever had that occur. We could potentially have it turned into a handwritten document. I mean, it seems pretty arduous, but I've actually, luckily, not had that occur.
We've done it several times, and what we do is, because we have some faculty who will not allow computers, and especially for things like a tax exam. So first, if it's someone who can't fill in bubbles for any reason, you know, limited upper body mobility, you know, carpal tunnels, we just have them circle with whatever writing implement they can circle on the sheet. And then the registrar and I are the only ones that can, we check, double check, triple, quadruple check the bubble sheet, and we fill in the bubble sheet for that student. Same with the writing. Either the registrar or I are the only ones allowed to put that exam into script or into handwriting, and then we double check each other to make sure the exam is correct, but it doesn't go outside the two of us.
It is
arduous, believe me.
Oof. That's actually what I was just going to say. Like, when we have students with dysgraphia, and more often than not, the first-year curriculum, there's somebody who has a part or a significant part of their exam that's taken on Scantron. So when that is the case, we have the students circle it on their exam, and I'm actually the person who transcribes it onto the Scantron sheet to then move it forward in the grading process. So.
We do the same. I want to wrap up with a few minutes on autism and Asperger's, if I can. Can I just see a show of hands how many people have students on the spectrum on their campus now? Parents? I like to say I'm not only the hair club president, I'm also a client, yes. And that will age me in itself, yes. My youngest is. I was actually doing research on autism and Asperger's in college students when I had a third child, and lo and behold, they were diagnosed. So I rarely speak anywhere around the country where there aren't parents, so welcome. And I think it's really important for us to realize a number of things. Number one, which is, and I'm not going to go through my whole PowerPoint with you, but the numbers that you're hearing and the PCAs you hear and the bulletin boards you see, if you notice, they're all children. And we have this mindset in this country that autism only affects kids, and when they grow up, they magically grow out of it. Well, in higher ed, we realize that's not the case. So the numbers that we're seeing are very interesting. 1 in 100 folks is from the 8 to 12-year-old population. That was done a couple years ago. Those students right now are between 5th and 9th grade. So basically, what I'm here to tell you is we ain't seen nothing yet in terms of numbers, okay? The majority of the first bubble year of the kids that were born in 1992 are just coming up now to high school, to college. They're freshmen, and that is the first bubble year. That's not even close to the 1 in 100. Now, we know right now that about 28% of the population has bachelor's degrees, and about 8% of the population has beyond that master's doctoral degrees. That's in 2010. So if we look at those numbers in relation to the autism Asperger's numbers, that gives you some idea, because we don't have good numbers yet. We're doing several studies across the country. But all of those numbers are very different depending on which researcher you talk to. The 1 in 100 comes from the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, and that's pretty much what we use. The majority of you are going to see students with the label of Asperger's. And the scary thing, as we're all getting used to it, is that label is about to go away in the DSM-5. And the DSM-5 has decided to make all of the spectrum autism spectrum rather than the NVLD, nonverbal learning disability, PDD, pervasive developmental disorder, autism, Asperger's, high functioning Asperger's, all those confusing diagnoses, they're now going to call autism spectrum. It's my belief that a lot of our students who really own that diagnosis of Asperger's are not going to give that up. It's also a lot better to say to a faculty member, you have a student in your class with Asperger's than you have a student in your class with autism. Because autism conjures up an idea of what, my son's very low functioning, and it conjures up more of that idea, the nonverbal child who's rocking in the corner, rather than the Temple Grandin idea, or the, you know, a lot of people say Bill Gates has Asperger's. It's never been disclosed, but that's what a lot of the media is portraying. So if that's the model that people have as opposed to what they see of autism, people are much more comfortable with the Asperger's diagnosis. According to the DSM-4, the difference is when language was developed. If your language developed on time, you could be under the diagnosis of Asperger's. If you had any delay in language, no matter if you are very high functioning, you have very few symptoms as a teenager or young adult, you had to be considered autistic, because that's where the line of demarcation was. So that's just the difference in the terminology, just so you know. Whatever you see with parents now, it's much more intense with the kids with Asperger's. And the reason is there's a professor in Australia named Tony Atwood, who's the foremost researcher in this area. And the way he describes it is that before the child with Asperger's leaves home, the parents act as interpreter for this child. They interpret the child to the world, and they interpret the world to the child. Once that student goes away, and maybe he didn't go away for college, and maybe now he's going away for law school, who's going to interpret? It's a scary thing, and so parents are very, very connected. And I often say, in order to get the parents out, you have to bring them in first. So if you bring them in and say, listen, I understand what you're doing. I understand why you're so concerned. I understand you've done a great job that your son or daughter has gotten this far. But now, here's why you need to back off. It will work sometimes. It won't work others, I'm here to tell you. So I think we all have to think about a few things with this. And law is always going to be somewhat of a draw, because students on the especially students with Asperger's, are known as being hyperlexic. From the time they're this big, they talk at a very, very high level, so that people kind of look and go, how come this three-year-old knows so much about fill-in-the-blank dinosaurs, weather, train schedules, Thomas the Train, all those things that we know attract our kids on the spectrum. And when they're seen as so bright and they get so much reinforcement, we know it's because they're really good at the talking. The processing doesn't work so well. The listening doesn't come so well. So what we're seeing is those students get so reinforced, and they keep hearing, the way you talk, you should be a lawyer. You know, they hear that from the time they're really little. And they think, I'm really good at arguing. I can talk and talk and talk. And many people are really good with history, political science, small facts. That is an area of interest for a lot of our students on the spectrum. So I'm not saying our law schools are going to be absolutely filled with people with Asperger's, but it certainly is going to be an area of interest, and we're going to see a lot more people. Computers and engineering are also a big area of interest for people on the spectrum, so IP is a big draw in the legal world. So I think there's a couple things similar to students with psychiatric disabilities that we need to remember, and that is behavior is very, very important and behavior cannot be inappropriate in a high school classroom, a college classroom, or a law classroom. So if you're seeing extraordinary behaviors from students on the spectrum, you must do something to extinguish it immediately. This other students and the faculty do not have to be exposed and have to take a lot of class time by students who won't stop talking and students who speak 6 and 7 times per class. You have to interrupt it early rather than let it go on and become a routine and a behavior. I can, if you want to talk to me later on, we can talk about some strategies to do that. I don't want to take time now. But the behaviors in class and the behaviors out of class are important, especially with what we talked about with the bar and character and fitness, because a lot of our students are going to be our really bright lawyers, and we should encourage them. Along with encouraging, we have to say, you know, if you're going to be that really bright attorney that you want to be, we have to get some of these behaviors under control. You know, you can't walk around flapping. You can't, and we can change those behaviors to something else. But you have to learn to interact better. Every law school in the country talks about social interaction, and so far the only one to actually have charm school is MIT, not a law school. But MIT makes all of their students go through MIT Charm School. It's a required course prior to graduating. And I think especially if our students want to be attorneys, and they are going to be some of our best and brightest, we have to make sure they have the social aptitude to go along with it. And there's lots going on in research about that also. But it's not just our students on the spectrum. Our students with all kinds of disabilities are sometimes missing a lot of those social cues. Our students with nonverbal learning disabilities also. And we have to provide opportunities where those students can help catch up, because they'll always be a little bit delayed. Are there questions about students on the spectrum? That's like the nanosecond version of the autism and Asperger's in colleges, but it's a big part of what we now address in students with invisible disabilities. Are people having issues with students on campus, or is it the biggest issue for an overwhelmingly a male diagnosis, but the biggest issue for our guys on the spectrum on campus is stalking, because they don't understand the social male-female interaction, and so what their behavior is interpreted as stalking, and it's a big problem on a lot of campuses. So with that, any other questions on what Christy and I were addressing today? Seeing none. I want to thank you not only for staying this late in the day, and I so apologize that Salome couldn't be with us. I would encourage you to go to her website. She has really good information on her website, which is disabilitydirectresponse.com. And she will answer questions by email. And again, her apologies for not being here. But I want to thank you as a professional and a parent of one of these kids. I want to thank you not only for sitting with us today, but for all you do for all of our students all year round. Thank you.
And we're actually going to roll.